So we are holding on Chaf Beis Amud Beis, 12 lines from the bottom. The line begins Shechina. Okay, we were discussing the fact that Shaul did one major Avera that lost him his kingship, namely that he didn't destroy Amalek like he was supposed to, because even though we had before that, there was the thing involving the Korban and Gilgal, but if it had just been that, it would have meant that his descendants would still keep the kingship, but now it was lost from his family completely. Whereas we said David did two major aveiros and still didn't lose his kingship for it, and we said because Hashem was on his side with all the various meanings that we had of that yesterday. So we said the two of David were one that he had Uriah killed, and the other one that he counted the Jewish people when he wasn't supposed to. So now we were going through, what about other things that we find that David did wrong? What about the fact that he married Bathsheba? And the answer is that he was actually punished for that. And in fact, he was punished with his own body because he actually got, besides that several of his children were killed or passed away, there was also he himself got Zaras. So now another one, the Gemara asks, V'ha'amar Rav kibul David Lashon Hara. What about, do you have something else where Rav says that David listened to Lashon Hara? So you have like this. The background is as follows. There was a son of Yonasan named Mephibosheth. David had brought him to Yerushalayim and made him an honored guest in his palace. This Mephibosheth had a servant named Tziva. This Tziva apparently was always out to get Mephibosheth and to talk him down and then say that he's a no good Nick. So now, years later, when David was on his way, was leaving Yerushalayim, running away from Absalom, so this Tziva shows up with a couple of donkeys full of food for David and his men. And when David asked him, so where's Mephibosheth? Now, the thing is, Mephibosheth was lame. He had both of his legs were broken, so he couldn't walk. So David asked Tziva, where's Mephibosheth? And Tziva made up a story, or we don't know whether he made up the story, that's the thing, as we're going to see in the Gemara. So Tziva tells David that Mephibosheth stayed behind in Yerushalayim because he figures eventually now he has a good chance at regaining the kingship. Now that David is out of the picture, and sooner or later people are going to realize that Avshalom is a selfish little kid, then people are going to want back Mephibosheth, who after all is the grand son of Shaul HaMelech. So David at that point says to Tziva, whatever Mephibosheth has, I'm giving to you. Meaning, in other words, if it turns out that it's true and Mephibosheth is disobedient and rebelling against me, then I'm confiscating his property and giving it to you. Now, Rashi in Shabbos says that's not necessarily called kibul lashon hara yet, because David's not saying for sure I'm going to give it to you. He's saying if that checks out, right now I haven't got the time to look into it. I'm on my way running away from Absalom. But if that checks out, then that'll be the situation. Nevertheless, some of the Mephoshim on the Posif, the Ababonel, the Malbim say still it was inappropriate for David to speak that way. And in fact, the next thing that happened after that was that Shimi came out and cursed him and threw rocks at him and whatever. Still, apparently the Gemara is not focusing so much on that one because, that really is not, that's not full-fledged kibul lashon hara yet. But later on, a few prakim later, when David is returning to Yerushalayim after Avshalom was killed and the revolt is over, so Mephibosheth comes to see David, but he looks very unkempt. He hasn't trimmed his mustache. He hasn't he hasn't done various other things to neaten up his appearance. Now, why is that? I mean, on the face of it, you're going to meet a king. You should look neat. So is it that Mephibosheth was sad that David had to run away, and therefore all this time he had been staying unkempt in mourning for the fact that David is away? Or is it on the contrary that now that he hears that David is back, then he feels bad? Now all his plans collapse. So when David asks him, why didn't you come with me? So he tells him because Tziva took the donkey and left without me. And since I'm lame, I couldn't walk. So the pasuk continues that David is not really sure now who to believe. So he says to Mephibosheth, you and Tziva are going to divide the property. Meaning, in other words, like I can't decide which of you is correct and which is not, so therefore I'm going to sort of split the difference. He can get half of it, you can keep half of it. And Mephibosheth says, let him take the whole thing since you came home peacefully. So the question is, again, does that mean, is Mephibosheth being sincere about that? You know what, I'm so glad to have you back, I'd even be willing to forego all of my property as long as I have you back. Or is he saying it like sarcastically, as the Gemara mentions in Shabbos, and then as we're going to mention over here, that he's saying, you know what? Better you shouldn't have come back. And really, I'm upset with Hashem that he brought you back safely, because now because you're treating me this way. So this now, according to Rav, David did wrong in this and accepted Lashon Hara from Tziva against Mephibosheth, which he shouldn't have. So isn't that another Aveira as well? Why don't we say what happened to David as a result of that? So the answer is...
But why did he ask him what he meant if he had this problem?
Because you ask the person what he means, I mean, he's going to make up a story. So if David figures that he can't trust Mephibosheth fully, then to ask him to explain himself is not necessarily going to help either. Whatever the case, so according to Rav, David wrongly accepted Lashon Hara from Tziva. But the Gemara says, Kishmuel, this original statement that we said, that Rav Huna had said, that David did two Averis and no more, would be according to Shmuel, who said, Dama Loikibel David Lashon Hara. Shmuel says that David did not accept Lashon Hara because he had a legitimate reason to, as the Gemara says in Shabbos, that the Dvorim HaNikorim Chazadei, the fact that he saw that Mephibosheth is coming to him very unkempt, with his hair and mustache not trimmed, and his clothes not washed, etc., itself shows that Mephibosheth is not as respectful to David as he should be, and therefore, Mephibosheth said, Gamas HaKoyikach, also David figured is all part of that. So according to Shmuel, David legitimately listened to what Tziva said. It wasn't Lashon Hara, because in fact there was good reason based on Mephibosheth's appearance and his words to assume that he wasn't really as loyal to David as he should have been. And the Gemara continues, Olorav Nami David Kibbled. What?
He could have been, knowing about what happened with Bathsheba, he could have been swayed and David.
Yeah, there could be any number of reasons. Whatever the case, the point is, whatever, I mean, the Bathsheba was years before, but whatever the case, was it true that what Tziva had said, that Mephibosheth was thinking, I have now a chance to get back the kingship? Was it something else? Was it just that he gave up on David? Whatever it was, according to Shmuel, David had legitimate reasons for believing what Tziva said. It wasn't that he accepted Lashon Hara. And the Gemara continues, Ola Rav Nami, and even according to Rav, Yomer Kibel David Lashon Hara, where again Rav says that David acted wrongly over there and shouldn't have listened to Tziva. Well, the fact is, Hori Poru Mine, we do in fact see that he was punished for that, so you can't say it's something that he got away with. When David says to Mephibosheth, Amarti Ata Tziva Tachlok Wazasada, I've said that you and Tziva will divide the field, meaning the property. Then a Baskel came out and said, Rechavam Yeravam will divide up the kingship. In other words, so there was a consequence of this. David is, according to Rav, David is inappropriately confiscating property from Mephibosheth and giving it to Tziva, the Baal Lashon Hara. So the result is that two generations later, Hashem made that the kingship was divided, and Yeravam, who was originally a servant, a subject of Shlomo and of Rehavam, ends up getting a large part of the kingdom. Now, the Gemara did mention before, we did talk about before, that we wanted a Puranus Beguf. We wanted to find that David was punished on his own body. Here it's not, because it happened long after David passed away, but still, the fact that Tosfos Yeshayahu says, that again, first of all, we don't necessarily have to say Rav Huna is agreeing with Rav. We just said that Rav Huna could be agreeing with Shmuel that anyway David didn't even accept Lashon Hara. But even according to Rav, we could say the fact that his descendants lost the kingship or a large part of the kingship is counted as a Puranus Begufay. To say, for example, let's say that his children passed away or were killed or whatever is not so much Begufay. I mean, obviously he was grieved about it, but it's still not something on his own body, but that his descendants should lose the kingship, which David had been promised that his descendants are going to have the kingship forevermore, and it should have been, if it hadn't been for this, over the whole Jewish people, that can be counted as a Puranus against David himself. Okay. Getting back now to Shaul. So we said that Shaul did one Aveira and he lost the kingship, right? The Pasuk says, to begin with, Ben Shtana Shaul B'Mochoi. Literally, it means Shaul was a year old when he became king. So what does that mean? Obviously, he was a grown adult by the time. So Omer Apone means Keben Shana, means what Shaul became king. He was like a one-year-old baby, Shalai Tom Chet, where a baby at that age has not yet tasted the taste of Averis. So to say, in other words, he's a baby at that age, is a complete tzaddik. So the same way Shaul at that age, the same way Shaul, when he became king, was a complete tzaddik. There is actually a medrash that says on this that one, even if there were any averus that Shaul had done before that, when he became king, all of those were forgiven to him. And there's a medrash that says that there are three cases where a person is forgiven all of their averus, and one of them is when they assume high office, like Shaul became king. So Maskef of Nachmi, Tzok of Nachmi, Tzok asks on that, how do you know the Ben Shana means in terms of that he didn't have averus? The Emek Ben Shana Shemaluch Batit Ritzaya. Maybe the comparison is to a year-old baby who's filthy with dirt and mud. Now, Tosfos Yeshanim says, I mean, what is Rav Nachman Yitzchok thinking to say such a thing about Shaul? What it means is, maybe Shaul is not makbid on his cupboard. Just like a baby doesn't mind getting dirty, maybe the same way Shaul was a humble person and he didn't care if he gets dirty or people don't give him covered or whatever. Still, though, it was an inappropriate way to speak about Shaul. So, Achviulei, Rav Nachman, Siyuta v'chelmei. That night, Rav Nachman was shown a Siyuta in his dream. Rashi says Siyuta means Malachi Pachad, Mavhilim, means scary Malachim. He saw a vision of scary Malachim that are coming to, frightening Malachim that are coming to scare him. The Meiri says a different explanation, that it means a whip. Whatever, he realized that was because of the way he had spoken. Omar, so he says, Na nesi lachem atzmeis shol ben kish. I've spoken too much against you. In other words, I want to ask from the chila, bones of shol ben kish. Why is he mentioning particularly the bones? There's a few explanations, but one of them is, Marsha says, because we find the Gemara mentions elsewhere that a person who's jealous of other people during their lifetime, then their bones end up rotting, but if not, they're not. So Rav Nachman Yitzchok figured that Shaul, we know that Shaul, the large part of his reign, he was pursuing David all over the place, so that shows that he had this inappropriate jealousy, and therefore maybe his bones shouldn't last in the grave, but now that he realizes actually that Shaul is a tzaddik, and therefore he has malachim, or whip, coming in to warn him that he shouldn't be talking against Shaul, then he says, bones of Shaul, I realize now that your bones deserve to still be intact because you didn't in fact show inappropriate jealousy towards David. You had valid reasons for what you did. Therefore, I'm asking mechila from you. Well, still hadar chaza siyuta b'chelmei. He still saw another scary thing in his dream. He realized that the first time he had just mentioned him as Shaul ben Kish without giving him his proper title. The second time he said Melech Yisrael, and then the nightmares stopped. By the way, though, the flip side of it is, going back to David, Tosfos asks, there seems to be another thing that we find that David did wrong. In Tillim and in Shmuel Beis, David sings his song, by David, David, Lashem is called Divir Ashir Azois. He mentions specifically the fact that Hashem saved him from Shaul, and Hashem criticized him for that. He says, Shaul was actually a greater tzaddik than you. Why are you singing Shira about his downfall? So why don't we count that over here? So Tosfos says, okay, because look, I mean, yes, it was a mistake of David, but you can't really, I mean, the fact is, Adonim Nitbas Al Tzaira, you can't hold David responsible as an Aveda for that, because after all, the fact is Shaul was pursuing him, and he had a certain right to feel good that Shaul was finally out of the picture. But still, Hashem criticized him that he shouldn't have sung Shira for it, but you can't consider that an Aveda, per se. But we see from this Gemara over here that Shaul was actually a great tzaddik, so much so that when Rav Nachman Yitzchok said something, even if he meant it respectfully, but he spoke in a disrespectful way, then he was shown a vision, min ha-shamayim, that he shouldn't do that. Okay. Next, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, mitnei ma'ala nimshecha malchus beis Shaul, why taka did Shaul's reign not continue on? Now, of course, we know why, because of the story with Amalek, but the question is, why Hashem put him in that situation in the first place? So the reason is, mitnei shalahayu beis shum doifi, because there was no flaw in his ancestry. So the problem is, therefore, if there was a dynasty coming from him, then the kings who descended from him are going to lord it over the Jewish people, saying, we're so much greater than you. Whereas David descends from Rus HaMoaviah, and we know that throughout David's life, in fact, people were harassing him about that and claiming that his ancestry is flawed. So the Amar of Yechin, Meshum Reb Shemeni Meni Haytzadak, Ein Ma'amid and Parnas Alat Zibur. We do not appoint a Parnas, a leader over the community. Elim can Kupa Shal Shrotzim Tvoyolei Ma'achorav, unless he has a basket of Shrotzim hanging behind him, which is a metaphor, meaning, in other words, that there's some flaw in his Mishpacha. This way, if he or his descendants become proud, we tell them, look what was before you, look what lineage you come from, and therefore have a little more humility. There's a sicha where there's a sicha from Tavshin Chav Dalet where the Rebbe talks about this at some length and explains the idea is, first of all, we're saying the Kupa Shal Shrotzim has to be Me'achorav, which literally means behind him, in other words, in the past. It can't be something that's befun of, because that would represent that in his Pnimius, he has a Kupa Shal Shrotzim, and that's no good. He needs to be on a high level in order to guide the people. But the point is, in other words, when we say that he has to have this Kupa Shal Shrotzim Me'achorav, it represents the idea he has to be on some level. He has to be able to relate to the people on their level, as opposed to the problem with Shaul is he's higher than the people, and therefore he can't lower himself to relate to them. And the Rebbe connected it, for example, with the famous story with the Mittel Rebbe, where someone came to him by Yechidus asking for tshuva on a certain terrible aveira that he had done, and the Mittel Rebbe had to work hard to find some semblance of that aveira in himself, not the aveira itself, obviously, but something that would vaguely resemble it, in order to then be able to put himself in that person's to put himself on that person's level and be able to give him advice for Yechidus. Similarly, over here, the Paroness has to have the Kupa Shal Shrotzim in order to be able to relate to the Hamoinam. And the Rebbe goes on to say over there that really when you get down to it, therefore it means that Shaul versus David represents Tzadikim versus Balei Tshuva. So David represents the Avodah of the Baal Tshuva. Not that we actually go and tell him, remember that your great-grandmother was a Diodas. We know that you're not allowed to remind a Ger about his past. But what it means is, in other words, that it evokes in him a certain degree of humility because of realizing that his life is that his life and his metzius is a metzius of tshuva, and therefore that he'll relate to the people differently. The Gemara continues, Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, mipnei ma nena Shaul, why was Shaul punished? That, again, to be in a situation where he ended up losing his kingship. The reason is because he was moichel on his kavod, and a king is not supposed to. Melech shemochel akvoide ain't kvoide mochel. So early in his kingship, he was moichel on his kavod, and with that, Rashi says he demonstrated that he's not fit to rule over the Jewish people. So what happened? Shadema, the pasuk describes how after Shaul was anointed, so not everybody fully accepted him as king. The pasuk says, "Uvnei Blial Omru." The wicked people said, "Mayesh Yenuzeh, how is this guy going to help us?" Vayivzuhu, and they mocked him. V'loy heviu leMincha, they did not bring him presents like you're supposed to a king. Vayihikim Machrish, and the pasuk says, Shaul was quiet about it. He didn't react. And then, and then the pasuk continues that Nachash Amoni, the Nachash king of Ammon, came and besieged the Jewish city of Yavesh Gilad. The upshot is that Shaul ended up fighting against him. That's the war that we mentioned yesterday, where before they went to war, he counted his soldiers using broken pieces of earthenware because they were too poor to afford anything else. And anyway, the point is that he ended up defeating Nachash, and at the end of that, the people said, now everybody's ready to accept Shaul as king. And they said, who was it that was saying Shaul shouldn't be king? Tnuha Nashim and Misin, give over those people and let's execute them. And Shaul says, don't, let's not execute anybody. And they renewed Shaul's kingship, and you have the Haftarah of Parshas Korach takes up from there. So the point is, in other words, that was inappropriate of him, first of all, to be moichel, to begin with, when they're making fun of him, then fine, he's not fully accepted legitimately as the king yet, so okay, but afterwards, when the people are saying, let's find those people who said that, and let's punish them, and Shaul is saying, no, he shouldn't have done that. He should have had that, yes, let those people be punished for their chutzpah. So in this connection,
he showed a lot of compassion.
It's very nice to show compassion, but a king has to realize Melech Shmochel Kvode ain't Kvode Mochel. A king can't be Mochel on his covered, because his covered is the covered of the whole Jewish people. So therefore, so he shouldn't have shown that compassion, and the fact that he did showed that he wasn't qualified to rule over the Jewish people. Which the Gemara continues, and once we finish this piece of Gemara, then we'll understand a little bit more about what Shaul did wrong. in this connection. So, Amar Rav Yechon, Mishum Rav Shimon Min Yehetzadeh, Kol Tamid Chacham She'ein Noikev V'Noiter K'Nachash, a Tamid Chacham who doesn't take revenge, who doesn't bear a grudge like a snake, Ein a Tamid Chacham, is not a Tamid Chacham. Now, what does that mean? The Gemara itself asks, before we even get into what it means, what the comparison is, like a snake, etc. But wait, Vaksiv Lo Sikem V'Lo Siter, the Pasuk tells us, you're not allowed to take revenge, you're not allowed to bear a grudge. So what are we saying a Tamid Chacham should do that? The answer is Ahubu Momon, that the Torah, when the Torah is saying Lo Sikem V'Lo Siter, is talking in monetary matters. The Tanya, as we learn in a Braisa, Ezeri Nekima V'Ezeri Netira, what is the definition of Nekima and of Netira? Nekima would be, for example, Omer Loi Hashileni Magocha, Reuven asks Shimon, lend me your sickle to harvest grain. Omer Loi Lav, and Shimon says, no, I don't want to lend it to you. Lamacha Omer Loi Hu Hashileni Kadrumcha. The next day, Shimon comes to Reuven and says, I'd like to borrow, lend me your axe. So, if Omer Loi Eini Mashilcha Kederach Shaloi Shaltani, if Reuven says, I'm not going to lend you my axe because you didn't lend me your sickle, Zuhi Nekima, that would be an example of Nekima, and the Torah tells us don't do that. The Ezuhi Netira, and then what is Netira, bearing a grudge, is Omer Loi Hashileni Kadrumcha, if Reuven comes to Shimon and says, lend me your axe, and Shimon says no. L'macha amalei hashileni chalukcha. The next day, Shimon comes to Reuven and asks, let me borrow your shirt. And if amalei heilach, if Reuven says to him, here it is, eini kemoscha shaloi shaltani, I'm not going to be like you where you refuse to lend to me. Zuri netira, that's called netira because he's keeping it in his heart rather than forgetting about it. And the Torah is saying, don't do that either. Don't put a guilt trip on the guy. So therefore, so this applies in matters of mammon. So this applies in matters of mammon, not in other areas. In other areas, where staying a tamid chacham is able to be noikav and noitim kenachash. So now, what do we mean by that? I mean, the Gemara is going to go on to say that even when it comes to tzar of guf, it's still a good thing to forgive him. So let's continue. Let's go through till the two dots. Then we'll talk about the various questions and the various things that come out of this. And then the various understandings. So the Gemara asks, "Tzaira de guf faloi." You're telling me even if the person hurt him in his guf, for example, injured him, he's allowed to do nekama or netira. V'hatanya, we learn in a brisa, and they're loving ba'en and irvin. Those who are insulted, but they don't insult back. Shtroimen cherposan ba'en and meshiv, and they hear people embarrass them, and they don't reply back. They do mitzvahs out of love of Hashem. They're happy when Hashem gives them yisurim because they realize it's cleaning up their averus. About such people, the pasuk says, the ones who love Hashem will be like the sun when it comes forth in its full power. One point is, like we have the story over there in Chulin, where the moon is complaining against the sun. And the moon ends up having to become smaller, and we see the sun didn't react, even though the moon was trying to put it down and become greater than it. So therefore, a person who acts that way deserves to be like the sun. So we see, in other words, that even when there was tzar ha-guf involved, a person should be meichel. The answer is, la'olam d'nokit le'milibe. The answer is, we don't mean that he himself should take revenge on the other guy, but we mean he should keep it in his heart. He shouldn't forget it altogether. So that way, if somebody else wants to take it up on his behalf, then he won't object. Which was the case with Shaul. Shaul himself wasn't proposing to punish these people who had been disobedient and been chutzpahdik, but yet other people are proposing to punish them, and Shaul should have let them do whatever they want. Instead, he didn't. Instead, he told them, leave him alone, and we're going to be nice to them. So therefore, so that's what we're saying, he shouldn't have done that. So the question is, still, doesn't Rava say, we're going to learn at the end of the Masechta, that if a person overlooks his midos, in other words, that he's going lefnim mishuras adin, and somebody hurt him or insulted him or whatever, then he's willing to overlook that. Ma'avirin lo yakol shav, then Hashem, so to speak, is willing to overlook his averus, midah keneged midah. So we see it's a good thing to overlook it. The answer is demifayis ulei mifayis. What it means is, if they come to ask mechila, then he's willing to be meichel them, no problem. But until they're ready to come and ask mechila, and in the case of Shaul, we don't find that those people were coming and asking mechila. So therefore, so it was inappropriate of him to be meichel them. Now, the bottom line is, so we have, there's a lot of different things over here. This set was saying that the Talmud Chacham should be Nokim Benota Kenochosh. First of all, there is an explanation that's brought from the Baal Shem Tov that the point is a snake doesn't actually enjoy its food. A snake, we know, a snake eats dust, meaning that everything it eats tastes to it like dust. It doesn't eat for pleasure, basically. So the same way, when the Talmud Chacham is Nokim Benota, it shouldn't be that he's doing it for pleasure, that he enjoys getting back at people who hurt him or insulted him or whatever. He's doing it strictly because it's necessary to do Alpi Torah. Now, you have within that, so it's not so simple. First of all, I mean, again, the fact is we are saying over here you should be mochel people. You have also a different Gemara. Marsha points out you have a Gemara in Megillah where they asked a couple of Chachamim why they lived long, and one answer was that they asked one of the Chachamim why he lived long, and the answer was because he's always mochel people before he goes to bed, which is what we say. We have the paragraph for Rebbeinu Shalom Harinu Mochel that we have before Kriyas Shema Shalamita, where we forgive everybody who harmed us that day. So we see that even then he should do that. So there's a couple of different Rishonim bring different possibilities. The Ritva says there's a difference whether they insulted him in something that has to do with the Torah. Then he can't be mochel to them, because that involves the honor of the Torah. As opposed to, if it was something personal, then he could, which obviously to be able to tell which is which and be able to know is not that easy a thing, especially because for certain purposes in Halacha, we say for certain purposes in Shulchan Aruch, we don't even consider that we have Talmid Chachamim of high caliber nowadays. So not necessarily that a person can actually be mekayim this and be menoto kenachash. Another different distinction that Amma makes, a distinction whether they insulted him in private or in public. Because when it's in public, again, there's more covered of Torah involved. So therefore, it's not so easy for him to forgive it. Because again, just like with Shaul, we're saying it's not his personal covered. It's the covered of the Jewish people. In the same way, it's not his own personal covered. It's the covered of the Torah that he learned. If people insult him before Hesia, and he forgives them and lets them off the hook, then people learn that you don't have to treat Talmid Chachamim respectfully. There is also, the Alter Rebbe does bring in a couple of places in Shulchan Aruch, that the truth is, if somebody harmed you, begufa, it's tsayra degufa, like we're saying over here, then you are entitled, you are entitled, api halacha, to hate that person. Even if you're not a Talmid Chacham, you have the right to hate that person because of what they did. However, if they come and ask mechila, then you have to be mechil them, which is what we're saying over here, therefore. So even with the Talmid Chacham, as long as the person doesn't ask mechila, then he is entitled to bear that grudge. And again, like Rashi is saying, if somebody else wants to go and get back at that guy on behalf of the Talmid Chacham, then he should let it. Unless the guy asks mechila, and then if he asks mechila, then it shows. Obviously, he has covered for Talmid Chacham after all, and then you should forgive.
But let's talk about the common man, because the common man is more common than the Talmid Chacham. What right. should his attitude be?
So his attitude should be that if the other person hurt him, so it depends. He has so if it was a matter of mamon, then he's not allowed to do nekimo and netira at all. Then he has to completely forgive it. If it was a matter of tsar haguf, as we're saying over here, then he is entitled al pi halacha to hate the guy and to get back at him. But it's better if he doesn't, because we're saying haner lovin vein and oven. It's better if he doesn't. It's better if he doesn't insult the person back or hurt the person back or whatever. And also kalam avra midosav. So it is better if he forgives the person, but he has the right, al pi halacha, to hate that person until he comes and asks him mechila, and obviously if there's compensation involved, then to compensate him as well.
Why shouldn't that apply to mammon?
Because mammon is different, because mammon is, okay, so the guy didn't want to lend you his axe or whatever, so a big deal. That you should be willing to overlook. But tsar haguf is something that the average person is not going to, the Torah doesn't expect you to be a malach. So if somebody actually harmed you in your body or whatever, then you can't be expected such a high standard. I mean, it would be a nimishur sadin to do that, and a person does that is oyavav could say sashem mishpig vurasai, but at least he is technically allowed up here halacha then to hate the person and
don't we say that the mammon is like the goof in a way?
No, not necessarily. Mammon is not always like the goof. I mean, you have sometimes, we have in yesh l'chadim should mammoni chalav olam migufay, but come on, that's not the normal way of things. One other thing before we go on to the next sugya. Why do we have over here in these two cases of Nekima and Natira? First we have he wants to borrow a sickle, and the other guy wants to borrow an axe, and then we have the one guy wants to borrow an axe, and the other guy wants to borrow a shirt. Why are we changing that? So some of the Mephoshim say that just the style of the Gemara is we use different things in order to vary it. The Gvura Sari has a very interesting explanation. He says this is all one long story. What it is Reuven comes to borrow from Shimon, and Shimon says no. The next day, Shimon comes to borrow from Reuven, and Reuven says no because you didn't lend me. So the next day, the continuation of the story is that the next day, now Reuven has done the Avera of Nekima. The next day, Reuven now comes to borrow from Shimon, and Shimon says, Shimon says no. Without saying because you didn't lend to me, but then Shimon comes to borrow from Reuven a different thing, a shirt, and Reuven says, "I'll lend it to you," and even though you were mean to me and you didn't lend it to me, so he says it's all one long story involving three different objects: a sickle, an axe, and a garment, and going back and forth between Reuven and Shimon. There are other girsais over here and other explanations. One of them being the Ritva had a girsa where the first one wanted to borrow a sickle, and then the second time around with Natira, the same person wants to borrow an axe. And the idea is, even though an axe is worth much more than a sickle, so you could say maybe Reuven isn't doing anything wrong. He is lending him the valuable axe after all. But because he's saying that I'm going to lend you, and I'm going to be a nice guy, not like you, then he's over on Natira. Okay. The Gemara goes on. The Mishnah had said, "Umahin mitzian achas eshtayim mechula." We said that the Kohenim are standing in a circle over there for the counting, for the pious, and we said they can stick out one or two fingers. So the Gemara asks, "Hash eshtayim mitzian achas nevoya?" If they're even allowed to stick out two fingers, all the more so they're allowed to stick out one. Why does it have to mention that? So Amar Rav Chista, like Kasha, can be body, can be choila. It depends whether the Kohen is healthy or whether he's not feeling well. If he's healthy, then he sticks out one finger. If he's sick, then now obviously not too sick to do the avoda, obviously, but sick enough that he can't easily control his fingers. So if he puts out his index finger, the other one goes automatically with it. So then he's allowed to put out two fingers. And the Gemara says, "Vaha Tanya," and in fact, we learn like that in a Braisa. Achas mitzian, shtayim en mitzian. Normally, you're only allowed to stick out one finger for this counting, not two. When is that talking about a healthy person? Alva b'chola, but a sick person who can't easily control his muscles. Afilu shtayim mitzian, he can stick out even two fingers. The Yechidim stick out two fingers, and they only count it as one finger. Who are the Yechidim? Rashi explains it means sick people who are separated from everybody else. So in other words, these are Kohenim. They're obviously healthy enough to participate in the pious. They could conceivably do one of the avodas. But let's say, for example, they have a contagious disease. Let's say they have a cold or the flu or COVID or what have you, and they have to stay a few feet away from the other people. So they stick out. They stick out two fingers. There's a few other explanations. Rabbi Hananel and the Aruch say that the word that Yechidim means Tamid Chachamim, where the Gemara mentions elsewhere in the Dorim, that Tamid Chachamim often are unhealthy because they spend so much time learning Torah and not very much on physical activity. So they also, we assume to begin with, that they're weak and that they're allowed to stick out two fingers. There's a different gear source for Hayyirin, which means the proud people. Like these are people who are standing apart from everybody else because of their pride, because they don't want to just stand in a circle with everybody else. So whatever, those people, they can stick out two fingers. They only count it as if it was one finger. So the Gemara says, what are you telling me? If a person sticks out two fingers, they count it as only one? Vatanya, we learn in a braisa. You're not allowed to stick out the third finger, which is the middle finger. Veloy gudel, you're also not allowed to stick out your thumb, neha ramoyim, because of the cheaters, because like we learned in the Mishnah yesterday, the thumb being far away from the other fingers is very easy to position in such a way that it looks like somebody else's finger, and therefore to manipulate the count. Or the Rambam says to easily flick it in and out, and again, therefore, manipulate the count. So because of the cheaters. Now, though, if the Kohen did stick out his middle finger to get the Pashtus together with the other fingers, then we count it. L'chorda monim means we count all the fingers that he stuck out. So in that case, it might be three fingers. Gudol ein monim loy. On the other hand, if he sticks out his thumb, we don't count the thumb. The loy oed elishalokim in amamunim b'pakia. Not only that, but because he's trying to cheat, because he's using his thumb, which is there's a high likelihood that he's going to try to use it to cheat. Therefore, the one in charge of the Beis Mikdash would hit him with a whip. So we see on the face of it that however many fingers he puts out, they count him that number of fingers. The answer is not necessarily Maimon and Lainami Achas. No, when we say that they count it, we don't mean they count the number of fingers he put out. We mean they count the however many fingers he put out, they count as one. Okay, there is actually a different Girsa and a different explanation that the Rambam has, which after all we do, however many fingers he sticks out, we count that many fingers. And the Rambam's Girsa over here is not Sholish, but rather Sholosh. That you're not supposed to stick out three fingers, but if he does, then they count them as three. Normally, a person should only stick out one or two fingers. Okay, we said that if he tries to use his thumb, which therefore there's a good likelihood that he's using it to cheat, then we said that he gets whipped. So my pakia. So what he gets whipped with a pakia. What is a pakia? Omar Rav Madra. It's what's called an Aramaic Madra. My madra, okay, apparently the term that Rav used was not familiar to later generations of Amoraim. Amar apapa, metarka detai. It means the kind of whip that the Arab merchants use, the posik reshe, where the ends of it are broken up. In other words, Rashi explains the word pakia means something whipped up. Means in other words, like you can have a strap for whipping, which is the same width at the beginning at the end, or the end of it is all one piece, which is the usual kind of thing you would use for Malchus. Here you have, it's called in English a cat of nine tails, where it has a bunch of small whips at the end of it. The end of it is torn up, like is divided up into a bunch of smaller whips. So that way the horse feels it much more. So the person who uses his thumb in the Beis Mikdash gets whipped with that kind of whip, where he's really going to feel it. So in this connection, the Gemara says, Amar Abaya, Meresh Havamina, I used to think, Hoditnan, now we learned in a Mishnah, we learned in Shkolim a few weeks ago, Ben Bevai Mamuna Alapakia, we had a list of the 15 officials that were in charge of various things in the Mishnah Mikdash, and one of them was Ben Bevai is in charge of the Pakia. So Abaya says, originally I thought, Amina Psilta, I originally thought it meant he's in charge of making wicks for the Mishnah Mikdash. As we see that the word pakia is used in that context, we learn in a Mishnah in Sukkah about the lights that they had for Simchas Beis Yeshiva, mibloy michnes ha'koyanim, from the worn out pants of the koyanim, umehem yenehen, and from their belts, mehen ha'yum afid, they would tear pieces of cloth from those for wicks, overhen ha'yum adlikin, and they would use those to light by Simchas Beis Yeshiva. So therefore, ben beve, ala pakia would mean, again, pakia means whipping up. So it would mean that he's in charge of whipping up and making wicks for the menorah and for Simchas Beis Yeshiva and so on. Kivin d'shmaina l'hodetanya, but then when I heard this that we learn in a braisa, the loyod elashalokim in amunah b'pakia, when we said that somebody was trying to cheat in the pious, gets whipped with a pakia, Amina, my pakia nagda. Then I realize that when it says ben devei ala pakia, it means he's in charge of the whipping in the Beis Mikdash. If anybody needs to be whipped and punished in the Beis Mikdash, then this Ben Bevai is in charge of it. In fact, you have in Masech the Midyas, it talks about you have the Ish Harabayas, you have the official of the Harabayas who would go around checking on the Mishmaris on the watchmen, the Kohenim and Levium who are guarding the Beis Mikdash at night. And if he finds any of them sleeping, then the Mishnah says over there that he could beat him. So according to that may have been this Ben Bevai ala Pakia. That he's in charge of that. Some of the Mefarshim say that. When we learned in the Yerushalmi, in Shkolim, actually, a few weeks ago, the Yerushalmi stuck with the original understanding that it means that he was in charge of making the wicks for the menorahs. But here in the Bavli, we're saying that it means that he's in charge of the wick. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, Maisa Shoishnein Shoven Berotzen Va'odim Rakevesh, that we said originally when they had the foot race to determine who gets to do the Trumas Hadeshin. So we said one time two Koyanim were racing up the Kevesh, and they were both, and they were both almost tied, and then one of them pushed off the other one, and he fell and broke his leg. So the Moses turned around and Maisa Shoishnein Koyanim Shoishnein Rotzen Shoven Berotzen Va'odim Rakevesh. It happened once that two Koyanim were both racing, and they were going up the ramp of the Mizbeach, and they're both tied. One of them got within four amas of the other one, so the other one is worried about that the first one is going to win. He took out a knife and stuck it into the other guy's heart. Horrible thing. Amar Reb Tzadok al Milas HaUlam, so Reb Tzadok stood on the steps of the Ulam. Now, usually the Ulam means the entryway of the Heichal. But Rashi explains over here, that's not what it means. It means there were many, the word Ulam literally means a hallway. There were many hallways and large buildings that Hurdus built in different places around the Harabayis. Reb Tzadok lived in the generation of the Churban. He's the famous Reb Tzadok who fasted 4 years, and then Reb Yechin ben Zakkai asked Aspasionis for doctors to heal him. So Reb Tzadok stood on the steps of one of these ulamos in a place where everybody could hear him. For Omar, and he said, Achenu Beis Yisrael Shmo, our brothers, house of Yisrael, listen, Harehu Omar, the Pasuk tells us, Ki Yimotze Cholaba Adama, if you find a dead body in Eretz Yisrael, then the Yotzes Kenecha B'Sheftecha, then the Zkenim and the Sheftim have to come out, and they have to do an Egla Arufa. Onu al Mila Havi Egla Arufa. Here, who's supposed to bring the Egla Arufa for this dead body that was found over here? Ala Ir Ayala Azaris. Should it be the city of Yerushalayim as a whole, or should it be that the residents of the city have to contribute towards the Egla Arufa, or should it be from the Kohenim who are guarding the Azara? Go Kol Am B'Vchiyah. Everybody started crying, realizing what a terrible thing happened. Ba Aviv Shal Tinek, then the father of this young man, Tinek literally means a baby, but obviously it's not a baby over here. It means a young man. His father came, the father of the victim, of the one who had the knife stuck into his heart. Umotzik shum farfer, and he found that his son is still moving about. He's not actually dead yet. Omar, so he says to them, Harehu kaparaschem, he is your kapara. In other words, let his mister should be a kapara for you. Va'adayin b'ni mefarfer, and my son is still moving around. He's not yet dead. V'loy nitmas nakit, and so therefore, good, the knife at least didn't become tummy. L'lamnecha, the Brice says, you see from this, Rekosha aleb taras kelim, Yosef v'shvichas damim. We see that there was a very inappropriate way of thinking at that time, that people are more concerned about the tara of kelim more than shvichas damim, because we see the father is very cold-blooded about the fact that his son was just killed, but on the other hand, he's concerned that the knife shouldn't become tummy. V'chein hoimer, as in fact, you have a posuk that expresses this idea that they'd gotten very careless about shvichas damim. V'gam dam noki shofach Menashe habemoid. Menashe spilled a lot of innocent blood. Adash amilias Yerushalayim pelafer, until he filled up Yerushalayim from one end to the other. Now, Marsha points out this story over here with the kohenim and the one kohen sticking the knife into the other one happened at the end of the second Mishmikdash. Menashe was hundreds of years earlier in the time of the first Mishmikdash. What's one got to do with the other? The point is, Marsha says, because in Menashe's times there was a lot of shvichas damim, and we know, we learned earlier that one of the three averis that the first Beis Mikdash was destroyed for was shvichas damim. Therefore, even in the time of the second Beis Mikdash, they were desensitized to it, and therefore, so now the father could talk this way that he's not so worried that his son was killed, that he's more worried about the knife becoming tummy.
That's the precise definition of tuma. He was more tummy than anything else. There's tumas aguf and tumas anefesh. And his neshama was completely tummy.
The point is, we're focusing on tuma. I wouldn't say completely tummy, but yeah. It was obviously grossly inappropriate, as the Gemara is going to talk about soon. But the point is, in other words, why are we mentioning Menashe? Because of what Menashe did during Bais Rishon. Therefore, even during Bais Sheni, they were desensitized to that. By the way, Marshall mentions, you know, you have in the Gemara in Gittin, tells us that you had the Biryonim in Yerushalayim, who at the end of the second Mishmikdash, who were guilty of a lot of Shvichas Damim. So it wasn't necessarily prevalent among the people at large. We said earlier on Daftes that the second Mishmikdash, the problem was Sinas Chinam, not Avodah Zarah Gila Arayis Shvichas Damim. But nevertheless, there was a certain, that they were desensitized to Shvichas Damim, as we're saying over here. And the fact is, there were some people, you had the Biryonim, that were in fact doing actual Shvichas Damim. So then one asks, what
was the reason of that desensitization?
Because when you see a crime, when you see a certain crime being done over and over again, after a while you get used to it. Even maybe it's not something you would do yourself, but you get used to it. This is the normal way of things. So when there was so much of that being done in Menashe's times, then it made people less sensitive to the importance of every yid's life. So the Gemara asks, Hey Maisa Kodim. Now, so we have two stories. We have this story in the Braisa where one Kohen killed another one because he wanted to be first in the race. And then you have the one in the Mishnah where one Kohen pushed the other one off the ramp and he didn't kill him, but he caused him to break his leg. So the Gemara asks, Hey Maisa Kodim. Which story happened first? Was it the story with the killing happened first? Well, then, after such a thing, after such a horrible thing, the Chachamim didn't find it necessary to make a pious, apparently, because you still had the race, and therefore you had, again, that one Kohen pushed the other one off, and he broke his leg, and Nishbar Ragle Takinu. Why are they making a Takana when there's only a broken leg involved? Ela de Nishbar Ragle Kodim. Evidently, it must be that the broken leg story came first. Well, the Kim into the Kindred Piyasa. Well, then, if they made a pious at that point, Arba Amos Maya Vintayu. What for Amos? How could the second story even happen? By that time, you have a pious. As soon as the broken leg story happened, it says in the Mishnah, they made the pious. So there wouldn't be room for there to be a race and one Kohen sticking a knife into the other one. Now, So in other words, we don't understand what happened over here. So the answer is la'olam d'shvichas damim kadim. Ela la'olam d'shvichas damim kadim. In fact, the story with shvichas damim, the story with bloodshed, happened first. But umi'ikra savarak rai ba'amahu. When that happened, yes, of course, everybody was horrified. But the chachamim figured, this is obviously only a one-off. It's not going to be, and normally Kohenim are not going to be taking out knives and sticking them into others. Okay, you had one Kohen who was a lowlife like that, enough to do that. It's not enough to be mevatel this thing of the foot race up the Kevesh and to make a pious. Then they saw it's not even just this one-off thing. You have another Kohen. Okay, he's not gonna plunge a knife into the other one, but he's still gonna push him off the Kevesh up high off, and the guy's gonna break his leg. So therefore, even then, they're coming to Sakana, Takinun, Abon and Piyasa. Then at that point, the Chachamim made the pious. So it took both incidents for the Chachamim to realize that you have to have a pious. Then we said in the story, we said Omer Reb Tzadok Amayla Sa'ulam. Reb Tzadok was standing on the steps of one of the hallways of one of the big public buildings on the Har HaBayis. V'Omer, and he said Achenu Beis Yisrael Shmo. Everybody listen. Harei Oemekli Matzei Chol Ba'Adama Anan Amila Havi. So who should be bringing the Egla Arufa? Ala Ir, the whole city of Yerushalayim, or Ala Azores, or just the Azores. So the Gemara asked, what's going on? What does Reb Tzadok mean by that? But Yerushalayim basasuya egla arufahi. Is Yerushalayim the kind of place that even brings an egla arufa? V'hatanya, we learn in a braisa, sodat dvarim nemer b'Yerushalayim. There are 10 dinim that apply to Yerushalayim, v'zu achas mehen, and one of them is einam avia egla arufa, that the city of Yerushalayim does not bring an egla arufa because it has to be. The Pasuk says that if you find a body in the land that Hashem gives you to inherit, and as we learned earlier on Daf Yudbeis, Yerushalayim lo neschalka l'shvatim, Yerushalayim is not divided up among the Shvatim, it's the common property of all the Jewish people, therefore it's not subject to this din of Egla Arufa, which actually Tosfos points out. Now, we had a different opinion over there. We had the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that Yerushalayim was Niskalka L'Shvatim. But still, the fact of the matter is, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, that what Rabbi Tzadok is saying is not really Alpi Alocha anyway. The fact of the matter is, we know that Egla Arufa is only where you don't know who killed the person, and here we know who killed him. And obviously, the Azara is not a city. So obviously, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, Rabbi Tzadok is just saying this in order to make a point, in order for everybody to realize what a terrible thing just happened. The oid, so the Gemara continues, Loi noida mihi ko. See, if the Pasuk says that you bring an egla arufa when you don't know who killed him, Vaha noida mihi ko, here we know who killed him. So what does Reb Tzadok mean? So the answer is, Ela kedei lahayris bevchiyah. You're right, Reb Tzadok is not saying something which is completely valid opi halacha, but he's using it to make a point in order to make everybody cry, in order for everybody to realize what a low level they had sunk to. So not, but not that really opi halacha, they would be bringing an egla arufa. In fact, actually, Maharsha says another point of Lahavis Bechia is to make the people realize, you know what, we're worse off than, at least if it was possible to bring an Egel Arufa, then fine, that would be our kapara. But because now the circumstances are that we don't, because Yerushalayim doesn't bring an Egel Arufa, and because we know who killed them, etc., so we're even worse off, we have nothing available for kapara. And he says that's what the father meant when he goes on to say that Hareyu Kaparas, and Marshall says what the father is saying is, don't worry, you don't have an Egel Arufa, then his death will be a kapara for you. So the Gemara continues, the Braisa had said, Bo Aviv Shel Tinev U'Motzek Shul Mafarfer, the father of the young man came and found that he was still moving. He says, he's your kapara, and my son is still alive, so the knife didn't become tomei. This teaches you, we see from that, that Taras Kalim was more important to them than Shvichus Dam. So, so the question is, what happened over here? Shvichus damim hu dizol. Is it that shvichus damim went down in importance to them? In other words, that it should be, the Torah expects that a person should be very sensitive to shvichus damim. And in this case, they weren't. They'd become desensitized to it. Aval taras kelim kidekaima kaima. And meanwhile, taras kelim remained as it was. They weren't over machmir in that. They had regard for taras kelim as they should. But the problem here was that now they're careless on shvichos damim. Is that what happened? Oy dumo shvichos damim kidekaima kaima. Or is it the other way around? Shvichos damim was still as important to them as it should be. Aval taras kelim hidechamira. Maybe what it is taras kelim, they were being inappropriately machmer on it and not putting it in its proper place in the scale of values. So which is it? Toshma. So the answer is, we can prove since the Braisa mentions that pasuk about Menashe spilling blood, and we're saying that that was the problem. Shmamina, we see from that shvichos damim who dissolved. What happened was that shvichos damim became lighter in their eyes. They were desensitized it. But taras kelim kide kaima kaima, whereas taras kelim remained as it was. So the problem wasn't that they were machna on taras kelim. The problem was they were mako on shvichos damim. An interesting mosudik point from this actually is, when you think of it, according to the second way of looking at it, the second possibility that Gemara brought up, where Shvichus Damim was just as important to them, but Taras Kalim was more important, you could argue that shows that they were great. That shows they were great Hasidim. That a din in Torah of Taras Kalim is so greatly important to them. But we still see that we're saying the other possibility is the other way around, that they were desensitized to Shvichus Damim. So sometimes you see you can have a person does or says something, and there can be two polar opposites why they do that. It can be the same thing that a person says or does can show that they're on a very high level, which is the Gemara's hypothesis that it might have been, or on the other hand, it can show that they're on a very low level, which is what the Gemara says in fact was the case over here. So in other words, you can't always tell the validity of something just by the action. You have to also consider the thought process that leads to that. Okay. New topic, the Gemara says.
How do you make the difference? How do you differentiate them?
A person has to know for himself. A person has to make cheshbon hanefesh and realize for himself what they're on. In this case, in other words, for example, here the Gemara is finding for us, the Braisa is finding for us, that they were on a low level, that shvichos damim was light in their eyes. But in other words, what should have happened at that point? As soon as the father said that, he should have been thinking to himself, what am I saying over here? Am I saying that because taka, I'm a super frum yid, and I really have tremendous yiras shemayim? Or is it maybe that I've gotten desensitized to shvichos damim, which is where, and I need to work on myself to regain that sensitivity. Yeah.
Well, the problem is It happens all the time, that kind of thing. You know that.
Of course, that's a person has to make a cheshbon hanefesh every day and consider what they did and what they said and what they thought and whatever, and consider whether it's coming from a tahor place or chas v'shalom the opposite. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then you think that having so much Torah would make you think clearly. How come it's not the case?
Because a person still has to realize, first of all, you have to learn Torah with an awareness of the noisin HaTorah. But second of all, also, you know, you can have some a person can be learning the Torah helps control a person's Yetzirah, but still that means that a person could still have the Yetzirah buried deep where he doesn't even realize it and he needs to think of it.
And the Torah doesn't cleanse that automatically?
Not automatically, no. Of course, he needs to work on himself.
Why is that? Learning Torah is working on yourself.
It is, but it's not. You have to work on the specific areas of Torah that have to do with improving your midas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, onward. Since we're talking about Truma Sadeshin, so now we're going to go into a sugya talking about the details of Truma Sadeshin. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Ufosha V'lovash Godim Acherim. The Pasuk says, now we have to keep in mind as follows for the next sugya. You have this Truma Sadeshin, there's the everyday where one Kohen goes up to the top of the Mizbeach and takes a shovel full of ashes and puts them down on the ground near the Mizbeach. And according to Rashi, they get swallowed up into the ground with Erech Nes, and according to Rabbeinu Tam, not. And then you have they take the rest of the ashes and then rake them up into the middle of the Mizbeach, onto the Tapuach. According to the Rambam, every day except for Yom Tovim, they would then clear that off. According to Rashi and most other Rishonim, only when it became very full and it started to get in the way of things would they clear it. So that's a different thing. That's removing the Deshen outside the city. So the Pasuk says, about the second one, about removing the ashes completely from the Beis HaMikdash, from Yerushalayim, and carrying them outside the city. The Pasuk says, Ufoshat, he should take off his Bigdei Kohanah, the Lavash Begadim Acherim, and he should put on other clothes, V'Hotzi Yesadeshchen, and then he takes the ashes out, El Mechutz L'machna, outside Yerushalayim. So, based on that Pasuk, Shemani Kederach Yom Kippurim, you would think that it means that it has to be like on Yom Kippur. Shaposhit Bigdei Kodesh V'Loivish Bigdei Chol, where on Yom Kippur we know that the Kohen Gadol goes through several changes of clothing. So maybe what it means is that the Kohen, when he's getting ready to take the ashes outside Yerushalayim, puts on Bigdei Chol, rather than the Bigdei Kodesh that he does the Bigdei Kohanim, which there are different Gersois over here. Tosfos Yeshanim doesn't like that Gersa of Bigdei Chol, because the fact is, the Kohen Gadol doesn't change into Bigdei Chol on Yom Kippur. He changes from one Bigdei Kodesh into another. So he says, okay, but it means at the end of the Avodah of Yom Kippur, he puts on Bigdei Chol. Whatever, so maybe the Pasuk is implying that to carry the ashes outside of Yerushalayim is done in Bigdei Chol. No, Talmud Lomo, Foshat is God of the Lovash God of Acherim. No, the Pasuk says he takes off his clothes and he puts on other clothes, so the fact that it says Begodav and Begodim, Makish Begodim Shalovish, Begodim Shaposhit. So there's a hekesh between the clothing that he takes off and between the clothing that he puts on for carrying the ashes out versus the clothing that he wears before when he takes off. Having previously done Trumas Hadeshin. Mala Halan, Bigdei Kodesh, just like Trumas Hadeshin, he has to wear Bigdei Kodesh, and obviously so, because that's an Avoda. Afkan, Bigdei Kodesh, the same way to carry the ashes outside Yerushalayim, also he has to be wearing Bigdei Kodesh. Imkein Matam Lame Acherim, so what does the Pasuk then mean, Acherim? Means Chosim Mehen. It means clothing of lesser quality that's worn out a little bit, or that maybe wasn't made of such high quality in the first place, but still that's made of linen and kosher for Bigdei Kohanah. Rabbi Eliezer Omer Acherim B'Hotzi. On the other hand, Rabbi Eliezer says, since the pasuk says Begodim Acherim, other clothes, and right after the word Acherim it says V'Hotzi, he should carry out the ashes. Limit our koinim Balim Mumin Shekshirin L'Hotzi Adesh. This teaches us that Kohenim, who are Balim Mumim, are also kosher to take the ashes outside Yerushalayim. To take the ashes off the Mizbeach, that not, because that's an Avoida, as we're going to go on to say. But according to Rabbi Eliezer, Kohen Bal Mum would be able, so he's Acherim, he's like a different Kohen than the regular Kohen, is allowed to carry the ashes outside Yerushalayim. Okay. So two different opinions. The Tanakhama is saying that Begodim Acherim just means clothes of lesser quality that are a little bit worn out, or maybe that weren't made such high quality in the first place. And Rabbi Eliezer is saying that it means that Kohen and Balim Mumim can, which we're going to analyze that Machlokes now. So first, Amar Mar Acherim Pchosim Mehen. So first, the first thing we said is, according to the Tanakhama, Begodim Acherim means clothes of lesser quality, that he wears those to take the ashes outside Yerushalayim. So why? Because the Tanad Rabbi Shmuel. As we learn in a Braisa from the Yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, the Tanad Rabbi Shmuel, Begodim Shabisho Ben Kdei L'Rabbi, clothing in which you cooked a pot of food, in which a person cooked a pot of food for his master, Lo Yimzik Ben Kois L'Rabbi, he shouldn't wear those same clothes when he's pouring and mixing a cup of wine for his master, because the ones that he was wearing while he was cooking got all dirty and stained and everything. So the same way, in other words, it's not covered for Hashem that the ones that he was wearing while he was carrying out the ashes, which those tend to get dirty. You're carrying an entire pot full of ashes outside Yerushalayim, so the clothes get very dirty and stained. So it's not appropriate now to wear those same clothes to do the avodah inside the Beis HaMikdash. As opposed to the one panful of ashes that you take off the Mizbeach, your clothes don't get dirty from that. There's a sicha where the Rebbe talks about, a sicha in Chelek Lamed Zayin, where the Rebbe talks about the deeper idea behind that is, on the one hand, we're saying you wear different clothes. On the other hand, when you think of it, we're still implying that it's the same kohen, who does the Terumas HaDeshen, which is the preparation for the day's avodah. It sounds like, from the way the pasuk is phrasing it, that he's the same kohen who carries the rest of the ashes outside the Beis Mikdash. Now, obviously, it didn't necessarily, in real life, didn't have to be the same kohen, but the way the pasuk phrases it sounds like it's the same one. So in the sicha that Rebbe talks about, the deeper idea of it is that you have to be prepared to do any kind of avodah, whether it's directly something that's a preparation for avodah, like the Terumas HaDeshen, which is the first avodah of the day, or whether it's only something that's preparing for the preparation. In other words, we're here, you're clearing off the Mizbeach in order to make it, in order to have room on it to set up the wood piles and be able to bring the korbanos, still you have to be prepared to do either of those kinds of avodas. Don't think that one is less important than the other. On the other hand, you do wear begadim acherim when you're dealing with lower level people. Then, like we said before, you have to be able to relate to them on their level. So therefore, so to speak, you have to put on a different set of clothes, like less expensive or worn out clothes, representing the idea that you have to take yourself down to their level, put yourself to a certain extent in their shoes to be able to relate to them and to be able to help them in their avodah. Okay. So we'll stop over here and we'll continue Hashem tomorrow with analyzing the machlokas of Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim.
Shkeich.
Right, yeah.